So the core of our contemplative practice is around the development of the satipatthana, the establishings of mindfulness, the four establishings of mindfulness, or in Ajahn Jeff's translation, the four frames of reference, a very rich teaching that gives us guidance as to how to direct the mind, what it is that we want to establish right mindfulness around, a series of themes to contemplate, not just a state of mind of attentive awareness, but a whole grouping of contemplative practices that we can engage in that form the basis for the development of calm and insight. Sometimes the terms calm and insight and satipatthana will get a bit translated differently than how I've come to understand it. But essentially, really, the four satipatthana are themes that we can contemplate to develop both samatha and vipassana. Pretty much all of the different categories of teachings, the different contemplations that are given, the different ways of the different places, essentially, that we establish our mindfulness, all of them, in some way or another, do lead to both calm and insight. And the Buddha talks about the importance of those two qualities being developed together. Yoke-tied is one of the words that describes samatha and vipassana. So sometimes it seems like there's an artificial separation of samatha being encouraged to be developed for calmness and or concentration, in a sense. That's what you use to develop concentration, samadhi, and that vipassana is what's used to develop insight or wisdom. But it might be kind of a bit of a different understanding than I've come to understand myself, based on many teachings and just putting it into practice, in that they are developed together. And in fact, Ajahn Chah is very famous for saying that samatha and vipassana are two ends of the same stick. You pick up one and you pick up the other at the same time. Sometimes there's one that's leading the story, if you will, but the Buddha's encouragement is always, if you find it's very easy to develop calm and peace, but there's not much insight contemplation going on, then to find someone who can teach you how to develop insight a little more effectively, and vice versa, so that it's always encouraged to bring them into balance as qualities that we're trying to develop. And that the result of that, the result of bringing these two qualities into the fore and developing them through the satipatthana, the result of that is actually sammasamadhi, the mind that becomes collected and gathered, composed into a very powerful tool to be able to start the process of seeing clearly and relinquishing. So all of these contemplations in satipatthana are useful to developing these qualities. And just was thinking, might be nice to focus on one of them that's a very useful, very essential contemplation itself, in the fourth satipatthana, the fourth satipatthana being the dhammanupassana, the development or the contemplation of dhammas, dhammanupassana, contemplation of dhammas, of which there are a number of themes that the Buddha talks about in that fourth grouping. One of those contemplations that the Buddha encourages is the contemplation of the five khandhas, the five aggregates of what we normally think of as our being, the five aggregates of our conception of existence, of what we identify with to form this sense of self. The five khandhas, the five aggregates being form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness, divided knowing, vijnana consciousness, and that our sense of self is formed around any one of or combination of or all of the five aggregates of body and mind. So he spends quite a bit of time and effort and teaching to contemplate the five khandhas. And one of the collections in the connected discourses, the Samyutta Nikaya, is devoted entirely to that, the Khandha Samyutta. There's some really, really rich teachings in that probably many of us, most of us even here, are familiar with. Some people who are in the earlier stages of the practice may be less so familiar. So I thought I'd kind of hit a few highlights of contemplation of the five aggregates. It's kind of like a few of my favorite stories. And there's different ways that, different qualities that one can develop insight and calm around within the five khandhas. And one of them is just starting to, one of the suttas that the Buddha gives is, or actually it's one from Sariputta, that talks about essentially the unreliability, because we take so much refuge, we put so much refuge into our body and mind. We spend so much time trying to find satisfaction within the body and within the mental processes, thoughts and ideas and the perceptual world, the feelings that we experience. We invest so much in this body and mind as a source of contentment, source of well-being. We're constantly looking for ways to improve our physical health, our mental health, the way that we perceive of ourselves, the way that we conceive of the world around us, in trying to tweak it for a sense of satisfaction, a sense of pleasure, a sense of well-being, a sense of security, and a sense of continuity in our existence. So that the Buddha says, you know, we need to start really looking at that, because we pretty much spend most of our time in the world trying to maximize the potential of these five khandhas that we so strongly identify with in one way or another. And there's a sutta that starts out with one of the disciples of the Buddha talking about his views. He was kind of hooked by a wrong view that after the death of an enlightened being, that essentially that's the annihilation of self. So he held this annihilationist view, and the fellow monks around him tried to dissuade him of that annihilationist viewpoint, and word got out to, I think, yeah, it was Sariputta, I believe, and was sent. Sariputta came to dissuade him, pull him from that right view, and started to quiz him a bit, questioning around aspects of the khandhas, the five khandhas, in the way that he was holding them that led to this wrong view. And eventually he came to realize that he was holding a wrong view. And the striking part of the sutta is a simile or story that Sariputta uses to describe the process of this body and mind and its kind of deceptive qualities. And he says, suppose there's a wealthy man who is looking to hire a servant, a servant to help him out, a butler kind of a thing. And a man comes along who is intent on causing harm to this wealthy man. And in the interview and in the establishing of the role of him being a servant, the man who's coming along to be his servant is very good at establishing his trustworthiness. He gets hired for the job, and then he starts to do his duties in a very impeccable kind of a way. He's always getting up just before his boss, his master, is getting up, so he's always there to help him with his morning duties as he's arising. He's there, he's attentive, he gets him what he needs, he satisfies his various needs, and is always doing it with this sense of calm and trustworthiness. He goes to bed after his master is settled in for the night, so he's always present and just incredibly attentive. And over time, the man becomes very used to that and starts to just feel quite settled, quite trusting, and relaxes around him, to the extent that this ill-intentioned servant finally finds the opportunity to fulfill his wish to do the master in. And in a moment of non-attention, the servant takes the knife and kills the master and betrays him, essentially. And Sariputta's questioning to the monk that he's telling this story to, he says, well, before this man was hired, was he a killer? And the answer is yes. Was he an assassin? Yes. During the process of ingratiating himself, was he an assassin? Yes. And then afterwards, was he an assassin? Yes, he was. And then the Buddha likes that simile. He likens that simile to the five khandhas, in that for so long, most of our lives, unless we develop some insight, we take refuge in this body, this form, the material form, the feelings, the different aggregates of existence, perceptions and thoughts and emotions and consciousness. We trust it. We take a certain amount of refuge in using it for our pleasure. It developed this sense of stability, form of security in the world. And yeah, we know that it kind of gets sick every now and then, and we do what we can to take care of it, but we don't really think about it very seriously. And as long as we're fairly young, fairly healthy, then we just keep on operating with a sense of trust that the body will always provide us with the body and mind will always provide us with a sense of well-being, sometimes with its ups and downs, but generally we go to it for our sense of pleasure, our sense of stability. And as we get older, we get little reminders that things can go wrong with it, but we get our treatments and we set it back and into its normal rhythm, and then we take refuge in it once more until the final ending starts to come, and all of a sudden we realize this body is not going to last forever, and perhaps very soon it's going to pass away. It's going to go the way of nature. This body, this mind, everything that we've relied on, maybe we lose our mental abilities, our ability to think clearly, our ability to communicate and to establish contact and relationships, our ability to relate to the world around us will change and will fade away. And the promise that our body and mind gave to us, this reassurance, we've been betrayed. We've been done in. The assassin has taken its role and killed us. So the Buddha doesn't mince words with this kind of story. He talks very plain and very starkly to get our attention, because most of us are still caught in this web of delusion about what this body and mind means for us, means to us, and how we can rely on it. So really driving home that sense of impermanence, instability, and the resulting lack of satisfactoriness that can be found within the five khandhas. Another kind of approach that he takes is one that points towards dispelling the illusion of that we can get into with the identification with the body, the sense that this is me, this is who I am, and the mental aspects, the body and the mind, that some combination of these factors is actually who we are, what we establish an identity around, whether it's an identity that this is actually me, or an identity that is somehow possessed by some entity of a me, so that it's mine. So I, me, and mine are the fundamental delusions of how we take the five khandhas to be self, and all the various ways that that can manifest. And one of the teachings that he gives is a great set of similes, which are perfect for contemplation in any particular period of meditation, to take an act of contemplation, meditation not being just watching the breath and calming the mind, but any of these satipatthanas can be a legitimate meditation, and this is a very active contemplation. But starting to go through these five aggregates and one by one and examining them in terms of their insubstantiality. So you have form, and the Buddha likens form, the body, essentially, to a lump of foam. That when you see a lump of foam, say, on the seashore, And walking along from a distance, it looks quite solid. There's a configuration to it, a color, a size, and one readily identifies it as an object, and it looks quite solid. But then on close examination, it's mostly air and very fragile, falls apart with a little bit of motion or a little bit of wind or a wave hitting the shore. So the Buddha likens this body to that lump of foam. And I don't know if people generally knew the physics of the human body at that time, but when you think about the physics of it, actually, the physical reality, the body is mostly space. I mean, you think of it down to the atomic level and all the space between the little waves and particles or whatever it is that atoms are composed of, it ends up being mostly space. So essentially, we are this body is not even a lump of foam, not even that substantial. But it manifests in what feels like a really solid way. We've got a perception of density and weight and a certain fluidity, all the elements, the four elements that compose it. But it's essentially very, very insubstantial just in and of itself and falls apart quite easily in the death process. The body decays, disassembles, and doesn't, in the end, have really much of any kind of substance. The elements just go back to their elemental components and blend in with the environment around it. So what substance, the Buddha says, what substance can there be found in a lump of foam? What substance can there be found in this human body? Can we say that's who I am? Feeling, the feeling aggregate, Vedana, the transience, the rapidity with which pleasant feelings arise and then fade away to be replaced by unpleasant feelings, to be replaced by neutral feelings, all kind of going back and forth so quickly, how quickly a pleasant feeling arises and passes away, how quickly an unpleasant feeling arises and passes away, a neutral feeling we don't even register most of the time. And he likens that to bubbles in a water, in a puddle. When the rain hits a puddle of water, a bubble arises and pops, and then another raindrop hits and a bubble arises and pops, and that just keeps happening in rapid succession. And it's an important contemplation because most of our time is spent trying to seek out gratification from increasing the pleasant experiences and avoiding the unpleasant ones. And then most of the time we're just caught in confusion when there's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. We don't even see them or experience them. And this is constant desire and aversion and confusion that's seeking out the pleasant experience and elimination of the unpleasant experience. So what substantiality can there be in that? Because no matter how hard we try, we'll never get all pleasant experience. We won't be able to avoid all unpleasant experience. And most of the time we're caught in a cloud of delusion so that we don't see most of what we are experiencing in the realm of feeling tones. So this is the basis for craving and the basis for the wish for annihilation are these pleasant and unpleasant feelings. And how insubstantial they are, is this a place where we want to stake our refuge? Buddha says, contemplate this, watch it. When the mind gets quiet, really watch these processes go along. The third aggregate of perception, sanya, often, I think there's a nice translation, recognition, which I think is a good way to regard perception or sanya, recognition. It's like the word cognition, which is the cognitive process happening, but it's a recognition, so that it's based on past experience. So perception or recognition, sanya, is based on our past experience. We have to have an intact memory, in a sense, that says, oh, I've seen that before, or I've heard that before, or I've had this experience before, and this is what it is. That is a person, or that is a tree, or that is the sound of a car. And this whole process of recognition of something rather than just experiencing pure sound or pure sight, for instance, just as a series of impressions on the eye or on the ear, but actually turning it into a comprehensible reality in a sense. But it's a perceived reality. It's based on past association. And this is how we weave our world. We need it. We need this aspect of our mental process to make sense of the world, or else we'd be just wandering around with confusing, chaotic sights and sounds and tastes and smells, etc. So we form it into a reality based on past experience. Oh, you know, that thing coming towards you on the sidewalk is, oh, that's a person way in the distance. Oh, gets closer, that's a male figure. Gets closer, that's, oh, that's a person that I recognize from down the street. And person gets, oh yeah, that's Bob. All of a sudden we've created Bob out of an experience of sight. This is the perceptual process, and it colors all of our experience. It's how we navigate the world, but it's also how we get confused and get into reactivity based on the impressions of a being or an event or an object as something that is going to either be a pleasant encounter or an unpleasant encounter, something that brings up a sense of pleasure, a sense of displeasure. And it forms the basis, the perceptions and the feelings combined together, the sanya and the vedana combined together, are the basis for which we then create the next khanda of volitional formations. But the perceptual process is likened to a mirage, the Buddhist simile of a mirage, so that it's very often very much a reality that changes so quickly, disappears so quickly, and doesn't have a substantial reality to it. It's just an impression that arises in the mind and disappears just as easily as a mirage arises on a hot day and shimmers and then disappears as it cools down or as we pass through it. It's not what we thought it was. It's not what we perceived it was. And perceptions change so quickly. How our day can be filled with, say, an unpleasant encounter with someone, and all of a sudden that person's a mortal enemy, and then 5 minutes later, something positive happens in the exchange, and all of a sudden that's your best friend. So perceptions are so unreliable, but yet we take refuge in them. And then forming that volitional, engaging in volitional formations, the actions that we take through intention in body, speech, or mind. So the actions that we take, the speech that we engage in, the words that we choose, the thoughts themselves are what we call these volitional formations, and they're based on this quality of intention or volition. And this is the basis for the creation of kamma, the creation of action, based on our perceptions and our feelings and the contact that we have with the world around us. We form a real strong identity around this. In fact, I think that for me, when I look at it, that actual quality of intention is so easy to get confused with the sense of self. And we think because we have this ability to change direction, to direct our thinking, to create a new way of looking at things, that this quality of intention that drives our wish to act, to speak, to think, this movement of mind towards creating some sort of activity, to creating some sort of formation or fabrication, that this impulse to do that has such a strong sense of me to it. It's like, I have the ability to direct my mind in this way. I have my ability to act in this way, to speak in this way, to choose my words. It's me who is rising up with this intention to do that. But on real close examination, we see that even these intentions are insubstantial. The Buddha likens it to a plantain tree, or a maybe more understandable banana tree, where the trunk, the bark, if you cut one open and start to unpeel it, you realize that a banana tree or plantain tree, as you peel off layer after layer after layer, then you finally get to the final layer on the interior, but there's no heartwood, there's no core to it. There's nothing that's substantial about it, similar to like an onion with all the layers, but no real core. And that's what volitional formations are like. They seem so substantial, but when you get right to the heart of the matter, there's nothing there that's permanent or everlasting. So that you see in moments of quiet, again, this intention arising, but it's based on some sort of previous event, some sort of contact, a sensory impression through one of the physical senses or the mental world, a memory. That's where the contact happens, and based on the perception and the feeling around that, maybe a wish to take action arises, this intention to act, body, speech, or mind. And so that the actual intention has a precursor, and it's just a moment of contact, which has its precursor, the existence of the sense bases and the objects that the sense base perceives. So everything, including the sense of me that evolves around the quality of intention, this, all of it is dependently arising and insubstantial. You can't find a self-existent entity in volitional formations. And then finally, the fifth aggregate for contemplation, vijnana, consciousnesses, sense consciousnesses, it's translated, divided knowing, if you want to take it etymologically, jnana, knowing, vi, as divided knowing, that form of awareness or knowing that differentiates into the various six sense bases, the sense bases of the eye, the ear, the tongue, the nose, body, and the intellect, the thinking mind, the planning mind, the organizing mind. This is what we call consciousness, divided in its most often used form, divided knowing, so that at any one moment in time, split second moment, our consciousness is absorbed in one of those six sense bases. Never at the same time will you experience, you know, two or three or four or five or six of the sense bases. It's always in rapid succession, one after another. The mind, the attention, essentially the consciousness darting between one sense base and another, creating a sense of continuity. It happens so fast that it's like a movie, you know, the old movies with the old movie process where you have a film with one frame passing through the projector and the light shining through it, one frame after another, after another, after another, and it creates an image of continuity on the screen. This is similar how consciousness works. And the Buddha describes that, likens that to a magician's trick, so that there's this constant weaving of a sense of reality, a sense of me, a sense of self through the workings of consciousness. But when you slow it down and when you see past the illusion of the magician, you realize that it's insubstantial, just like all the other aggregates. And the whole process of looking at the six sense bases and the consciousness that runs through them is a whole other contemplation in the fourth Satipatthana, the contemplation of the six sense bases, which itself is a rich exploration for a different evening of contemplation. But it's where one can, through contemplation, start to see the transience, insubstantiality of those six sense bases, and that there is a quality of awareness or consciousness that runs through them that can be, when it's not going out to one of those sense bases, it has a sense, the quality of that consciousness is the same, no matter which sense base it's divided into for that particular moment. And that's where we can start to get a sense of this the mind not going out through the senses, but the mind being separate from the sense-based experience, the quality of consciousness that is not going out and landing and proliferating through one of the sense bases. This is the fundamental insight that Ajahn Chah talks about attaining in the times that he met up with Ajahn Mun. This was what he learned. So there you have it. You have this contemplation of the insubstantiality of the five khandhas as a root teaching that helps dispel the illusion of me, of mine. And then you can use the five khandhas as a contemplation, as a source of freedom as well. The teaching, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, especially that first section in my mind where the body, the mind, the feelings, all the aspects of mind are regarded as essentially without the ability to control, that you can't always have good experience. You can't control the body and the mind, and that this lack of being able to always have it the way you want it is explored in this first section of the Anattalakkhana Sutta. And, you know, the Buddha talks about form is not self. If form, feeling, perception, etc. are not self, or if they lead to affliction, can you really consider them to be who I am? But they do lead to affliction, so that you can't say, let it be this way, the way I want it. And because of that, we can't regard it as anything that's under our control. And it's this this factor of uncontrollability that we come to understand and stop trying to once we realize the futility of it. So this is a source of freedom, because with that contemplation of the five khandhas and that growing recognition and seeing clearly what they are and what they're not, then we start to develop this. We've seen through the veil. We've seen through the enchantment of the five khandhas, the illusion of it being a sense of self or a source of well-being in the long term. And gradually, over time, repetitive contemplation of this will lead to that sense of not being fooled anymore, seeing clearly. And it's losing the enchantment. We become disenchanted, nibbida, disenchantment. And that opens up a sense of dispassion, where we just can't buy into it anymore. It's not compelling to pick it up, to seek after the pleasurable, to avoid the unpleasurable, to get it all confused with me and mine. And we just start to see clearly how suffering, dukkha, is created in this process of identification with the five khandhas. And we gradually learn to step back. It's not a process of creating anything new. It's a process of stepping back from all the ways we've engaged with it before and letting it come to rest. We start to see it with the quality of pure knowing, unadulterated knowing, knowing that sees directly rather than through the veil of confusion. And with that, we're able to relinquish this forward momentum that we call becoming, this wish to establish a sense of me in relation to the world around us in an attempt to control our pleasure and our pain. And once we can really, really step back and relinquish and let the kama process come to a pause, then we have the opportunity, possibly, for a glimpse of what we call the unconditioned, the non-creating, the non-manifesting mind that is at complete rest and stillness and non-arising, nirodha, non-arising, and the pure quality of awareness and peace that comes from that insight into the insubstantiality and the unsatisfactoriness and the transience of the five khandhas. So if you haven't picked up the Khandha Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya and done some reading from it, I really encourage. There's some really, really beautiful teachings there that kind of drive these contemplations, kind of drive them home for us. So I'll leave that for contemplation tonight.